Good morning. Welcome to the May session of the Nebraska Court of Appeals, Day 2. My name is David Arterburn. To my left is the Honorable Judge Everett Imbody. To my right is the Honorable Judge Francie Reedman. And we are sitting today in Papillion, Nebraska. Our other panel is sitting in Lincoln this month. We do just have one case on the docket today. I would remind counsel that if there is any sensitive information that you wish to speak about, that these proceedings are recorded and the recording is made public, and so you need to keep that in mind if there is any sensitive information that is to be discussed, such as names or anything like that. Our case today, though, is Sims versus Sims, and Mr. Bruno, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jason Bruno, here on behalf of Appellant Mitchell Sims, who is also present in the courtroom today. We are here seeking reversal of a decree of dissolution entered by Judge Randall of the District Court of Douglas County for the reason that it imposes obligations upon Mitchell that are unrealistic and that he simply cannot pay, and we believe are based on assets and income levels that do not exist, especially not anywhere in the record. So what we're here for is asking the court to correct the decree of dissolution in two ways. The first is to eliminate or substantially reduce the award of spousal maintenance, which was 96 months or a total of 8 years, beginning with $1,200 a month and then escalating to $1,500 a month starting in 2019. We don't believe that the circumstances of the case justify or warrant an alimony award in this case. By all accounts, Mitchell's income is $77,000 per year. In fact, Judge Randall found that Mitchell's income determined from all sources to be $65,000 per year. Teresa's income is $41,000 per year. She also receives a pension from her employer. She receives health insurance, dental insurance, things like that.
Where does Judge Randall make that finding?
He makes the finding in his child support calculation.
Well, wasn't that a stipulated calculation that he accepted?
Either way, if it was stipulated or not, I'm not sure, but either or.
But doesn't he in other places talk about other income?
I don't believe he does. I mean, I don't believe he does. He kind of hints at it, that there may be other sources of income somewhere, but the reality is there were not. I mean, that was Mitchell's income, as testified by Mitchell, as confirmed by his accountant, as confirmed by the tax records that are in the record. And if you go to Teresa, she also testified that she has no car payment, and on top of that, she receives $1,490 in monthly alimony from Mitchell. Teresa did give up her job initially in the marriage to care for the children, but fortunately, shortly after the divorce, she was able to get that job back at a higher salary. If you take Judge Randall's calculations and you adjust it based on the obligations that were imposed by the decree, on a monthly basis, Mitchell's net goes from $5,400 to $2,700 before any of expenses and before the $5,500 loan obligation that Judge Randall found was solely Mitchell's obligation. That puts him in the negatives under any conceivable measure or calculation. On the flip side, if you take Teresa's adjusted income, she goes from $2,700 to $5,500 a month. We think that was punitive, not fair, equitable, and unnecessary, so we would ask the court to vacate the spousal maintenance award.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
I understood that there was testimony that in 2013 that your client received a salary of approximately $46,000.
That's correct.
And then he also received dividends of $29,000.
That's correct. And that's where I got the $77,000 number from, and that's where Judge Randall got his number from,
But that only totals $75,000, so it would appear that there is additional income that's coming from someplace.
Well, you know, it's right around there, 75, 77. I mean, it's certainly no higher than that. I think you're correct on what the testimony was when you include the dividends that Mr. Sims received from Bill Sims and Associates.
And then go ahead. I'm sorry.
Then wasn't there evidence, other things that were paid by the business on his behalf?
Sure, there was some. There was some.
Wasn't there the $2,000 that was to be paid to the his mother to buy the business? I realize there was a discrepancy on that, but that's what the court determined.
Well, that was what the court determined. We conflict that.
But that money was paid, whether it was a loan or whether it was a buyout, it was paid by the business rather than by him.
It was paid by the business, but it was for an obligation owed by the business to...
Was there evidence that established that?
Yes, there certainly was. The accountant testified to that, and I believe Mr. Sims testified.
Was there a written document?
No.
Was there a promissory note?
No, there were not. There was none of those.
And then there's also, I believe, a second note or a second obligation from another individual. And I'm sorry, I don't have his...
Mr. Schott.
Mr. Schott?
Yes.
And the obligation for that is a personal note, correct?
Well, that's a big dispute. I mean, it unfortunately got signed by Mitchell Sims personally, but if you go
from a legal standpoint, isn't it individually as opposed to the corporation?
He did, and that was a mistake, but if
And if that payment is also made by the corporation, isn't that also income to him?
No, not at all. I mean, if it's truly a personal debt, yes, but you have to look at the circumstances. That loan was made in order to salvage the contract with the Harford and to make sure that Bill Sims and Associates was still getting its money from Mr. Schott. If that wasn't done, the Bill Sims and Associates, which Teresa was awarded half of, was done. It was finished. And the money went into
Bill Sims. So why wasn't the loan to the business rather than to him?
Well, I think it was just a mistake. It was just bad drafting in the promissory note. But the reality is the money went into the business account. The money was paid by the business account to the Harford, and that saved the company. And Teresa got the benefit of that, but she didn't get any of the burden.
Was there anything from the Harford to show that that's what happened?
Anything from the Harford? No, but the testimony.
But that's the problem. The testimony is showing one thing and the written documents are showing another.
Well, the only written document that showed another was the promissory note.
Isn't that the most important?
I don't think so. I think
Why?
It's certainly important because you have to look at the entire circumstances. You can't just go by a promissory note that says one thing, which Mr. Schott testified had mistakes in it or Scribner's errors. You have to look at where the money actually went. It didn't go to benefit Mitchell Sims personally. It didn't go in his pocket.
Well, what evidence is there of where it went? I couldn't find any evidence in the record of where that money went. He just said he spent it in his testimony.
No, if you look at my brief, I think I cited exactly where it was said where the money went and who it went to, and it went directly to the Harford. And if it didn't, that the company
no,
was done.
No, I know where the loan money went to. Where did the money that he didn't pay to the Harford in the first place go to?
Oh, that was spent on assets for the marriage. I mean, they weren't in the greatest financial condition. They had boats and houses and debts. So I think they needed a little extra money, and that's where it went.
Where does it say that in the record?
I'm not sure it does one way or the other. I mean, I think I agree with you, Your Honor, that it just says it was spent. It doesn't have any specifics.
Well, specifically, he said he spent it.
Yeah.
Your client.
I think that's correct. And if you go a second step further, I think the $205,000 equalization payment is another way to correct the record. All of the party's financial condition, assets, liquid assets are in the record. There's no possible way that Mitchell could pay $205,000 as a lump sum. He can't even pay it on a monthly basis due to the other obligations that were imposed upon him, such as the alimony, such as the child support, such as the $10,000 in attorney's fees. And I think that equalization payment was based on errors in the treatment of Bill Sims and Associates. First, we think that Bill Sims and Associates was a non-marital property of Mr. Sims. If you go back in the record, there was a gift made to him of 50% of the stock in 2004 that's supported by the minutes and the books and records and the accountants. We think it was error for the court to find that was 50% of hers. And if the court did give her 50% of the company, he had to give her 50% of that $324,000 in debt. We think she had to take the good with the bad, especially in this case when I think the evidence was undisputed that if that loan was not made by Mr. Schott, that Bill Sims and Associates would clearly have no value.
Did the debt was the debt incurred before or after separation?
It was incurred after separation, but it was incurred to salvage the Bill Sims and Associates, and then she got the benefit of that debt in the form of the value that she was awarded, but she didn't get any burden, and we don't think that's fair or equitable or appropriate. Now he's saddled with the $5,000 monthly obligation while she just got cashed out.
Well, couldn't have he put on evidence, I mean, as to where that money went that he shouldn't have spent? Couldn't have he put on evidence to show that that was used for a marital purpose?
Certainly. Certainly he could have, and I believe should have. But I wasn't involved in that point in time. But I still think you need to look at the big picture as to where that money went, or at least where the loan proceeds went, and that went to save the company, which she got half of. And finally, we think the valuation of Bill Sims that the court used was way too high. I mean, that company survives by the grace and the gratitude of Mr. Schott, and it could be cut off any time. That company doesn't have any fair market value. It certainly isn't worth $260,000. We would ask this court to adopt the accountant's value of $11,000. And if there are no questions, I'd like to reserve my 20 seconds for whatever I have left.
All right. That'll be fine.
Thank you.
Mr. Bellman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I approach?
You may.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ben Belmont, and I represent the appellee, Teresa Sims, in this case. The court's familiar with the record, and if you read the record clearly, Judge Randall did not abuse its discretion. The district court, in its decree, made detailed findings to support its decision, all based on the evidence, all based on the records. The problem that we had in this case was that the evidence that defendant offered to present seem to be contradicted consistently by their own documents. For instance, one of the errors that appellants complaining that Judge Randall made was the valuation of Bill Sims and Associates. We used Judge Randall's valuation, I believe, of $265,000, which is based on sufficient evidence from a number of sources to come to that conclusion. There was evidence of value in the record, and I'll get to that. But Sims had on his books the value of Bill Sims and Associates of $1.6 million. That was on the books.
And was that current valuation?
That was on the books as of 2014. It remained at $1.6 million based on that contract. If you review the cross-examination of the individual who held National Transit, if you look at the accountant's testimony during cross-examination, and even defendant's testimony, they all seem to be impeached with their own ultimate documents. I don't believe, and I don't think the judge found that their testimony was credible. And as far as Mr. Sims being able to make these payments, I'll refer to the court's own decree on page 6, where it states, after reviewing all the evidence, defendant's accountant and defendant made it clear to the court that the defendant's operation of this business clearly incorporates creative, if not suspect, accounting with regard to how the defendant's income is tracked and how his expenses are allocated, failing to articulate the actual financial benefits to the defendant as the sole stockholder of the entity. And then it lists 18 different items of which were benefits to the plaintiff, to the defendant, which weren't included or could be construed as being income. As to whether Bill Sims and Associates is marital, it was clear their own testimony. They offered the will, and if you look at read the will, he would only get stock in Bill Sims and Associates if he had not already had 200 and I believe it's 2,200 shares. And at the time his father's death, he already had approximately that amount. So he didn't inherit anything from his father regarding pursuant to that will.
So is it your position that that portion of it is marital? That he acquired that during the marriage and paid for it during the marriage?
The second half, that the 22, he owned 50% when his dad was alive.
Okay.
He acquired the remaining 50% after his dad died, and we couldn't figure out these $2,000 payments until then it all kind of made sense. He's paying after his dad died $2,000 a month to his mother. His mother was a beneficiary of the other half of Bill Sims and Associates because pursuant to the will, Mr. Sims already had his 50%.
Do you think that there's anything in the record that establishes how much of the second half of the business had been purchased from the mother by using that $2,000?
I think based on his own information, he now owns 100%. So,
well, but there's a, there would be a debt that he apparently would owe his mother from purchasing that other 50% that he's paying at $2,000 a month. At least that, at least I get that impression.
And
if that's the case, how much of it is, was there any evidence presented as to how much was still owed?
The appellant and the defendant never presented anything else as to what was still owed. I will tell you, if you go back and look at the accountant's testimony, he says there's no longer any money owed to Mr. Sims.
To Mrs. Sims?
Well, yeah, I believe to Mrs. Sims is what he, okay, he had said.
Okay.
As a result, and he did phrase it as a result of the stock purchase, because then nobody acknowledged that stock purchase. But it had, that didn't mean it didn't happen. Okay, so it, from the time of the death till at the time of the trial, he now owns 100% of that. The valuation that I was going to get to, as I indicated, on the books it's still valued at 1.6. That's exhibit number 21. And the court made detailed findings of how it arrived at its values. It looked at what was paid to the mother, the $2,000 a month, as just one evidence of value. It looked at the net stream of the income. And if you look at the other individual who owned a national transit, he indicated the rule of thumb for these types of contracts is 1 to 1.5% of the gross proceeds. So the judge looked at that. He looked at the paid up capital stock of $235,000. He looked at the minutes back in 2004, which it showed an acquisition of $125 a share for 2,175 shares of $265,625. And I believe that's where he landed in this case is what he had valued it. But he didn't look or didn't mention that he looked at, there was also an insurance policy out there. There was $500,000 insurance policy that the beneficiaries of which, it was on Mitchell's life, the beneficiaries of which were my client and also Bill Simpson Associates. So that, I think there's case law out there, that could be also construed as evidence of value. What was missing was any testimony from an expert on behalf of the appellant as to what the value of this entity is. It all came, we produced it all through the documents that they had it given us. They had their accountant
come. Do I understand that there was some information that they did not provide to you? I think it was...
Which time?
I believe it was in regard to the last note for $90,000 is what's in my mind. I'm remembering.
Well, there was a whole other entity out there that was never disclosed to us. We had... And that has to do with that National Transit that was on that promissory note that counsel had discussed. And on that promissory note, of which Mr. Sims was personally to pay back, I think it was $200,000 or $300,000, it was secured by a 20% interest that he holds in a company called National Transit, which was never disclosed to us. The individual who owned that company indicated that's valued at $800,000 to $900,000. And the judge looked at that and said, all right, we'll offset that against this $364,000 promissory note. The balance, I'm not going to require, I'm not going to consider that marital. One, it's post-separation. Two, it was never disclosed in discovery in his answers to interrogatories. And three, although the judge didn't make this finding, I don't know what happened in cross-examination. We don't know what happened with, in our brief we put it, we don't know what happened to the money that was received or why the premiums for the Hartford that he alleged wasn't paid weren't paid. And my client knew nothing about this. So, Your Honors, Judge Randall spent a lot of time, went through the evidence. Clearly there was no abuse of discretion in this case. And I ask that his decision be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Belmont. All right. Mr. Bruno, you have your, is it? 19 seconds.
Thank you. Mr. Belmont didn't answer the key question, which is where is Mitchell Sims going to get the money to pay the large equalization payment or his monthly obligations? And the answer is he can't. There isn't money sufficiently there to pay. The second issue is the will says Mitchell Sims gets half upon the death of his father of the company because he already had half in 2004. It gives him 100%.
Thank you
for your time.
Thank you. The case will be considered submitted for our consideration. You're excused. Thank you, counsel.